soften the social and economic impacts of unemployment, if not the psychological impacts. These don't terminate unemployment, however, but they help make it somewhat more tolerable for the unemployed. Secondly, we should look at the changes in the nature of the workforce. In 1929, the 49,440,000 people in the workforce were 64.4% of the population between 16 and 65. And there were probably higher percentages of the under 16-year-olds and the over 65-year-olds working then than there are now, because of the more recent tightening of child labor laws and stricter adherence to retirement age standards, with the more general development of private pension plans to supplement Social Security. By 1947, when the Full Employment Act was new, the percentage was still about the same, 64.9. But by 1975, the percentage of the labor force to those 16 to 65 was up to 71.2%. The entry of women into the workforce has risen from 27.9% in 1948 to 39.4% in 1976. Now, for the benefit of my colleague from Massachusetts who was here, that's not to suggest that the pre-1946 housewife was not working. Chances are she put in a full day on the family laundry, gardening, sewing, canning, but chances also are that she was not counted in the workforce, either as employed or unemployed. In those days, the head of the household wage earner was more often than today the sole wage earner. Today, there may be two major wage earners in a family. In those days, when the sole family breadwinner was unemployed, the impact on the family was considerably more devastating than where one of a pair of family wage earners is temporarily unemployed today. In that light, 4% unemployment then may have had a greater social impact and meant more shrinkage in spending and savings than a greater percentage of unemployment would today, with another wage earner in the family and all the economic and social supports we have built into the system since then. Third, there is the changing nature of frictional unemployment. Those persons unemployed through the technological shifts of whole industries, or who are not properly equipped to make transitions from disappearing jobs to new jobs. In some industries, it may be very difficult today to teach a highly skilled old craftsman new skills of a more intellectual nature required by technical change. In other industries, the job it once took years of apprenticeship to learn may be replaced by a machine which can be operated readily with very little training. Unemployment caused by changes in technological sophistication must be measured in aggregates of individual problems to determine how much frictional unemployment is correctable and how much of it is optional or endemic and will either cure itself or may have incurable causes. The teacher who left the workforce 20 years ago to raise her family may have to be retrained to a new job before she'll find employment today because her profession is currently glutted. But the plant nurse laid off from an industrial shutdown may well be unemployed by choice for a while because she may wish to enjoy a few weeks off with unemployment compensation before she goes back to work in the local hospital where she'll be welcome whenever she's ready. In this frictional unemployment category, we should also list unemployment due to problems of location or personal difficulties. The alcoholic worker may not be able to hold a job in the best of times, even though he possesses a skill in great demand. And the most skilled worker may never find a job in a geographically depressed area. These are specialized problems unlikely to respond to massive programs of federal employment. A generalized jobs program by the federal government as an employer of last resort may have merit in a generalized and lengthy depression of the 30s variety when it's deemed desirable to redistribute wealth in order to stimulate the economy by putting money into the hands of those who will spend it, although there are still many who feel that such efforts were not impressive in their success until World War II helped in recovery from the Great Depression. Even regional development programs may not help the alcoholic or lure the nurse back to duty before she wishes to be reemployed. But there should be continuing support for mechanisms to retrain the aerospace engineer or the linotype operator when his industry folds up or his skill becomes obsolete. And there are training programs which must be undertaken for social reasons to help achieve equality of opportunity for segments of our economy which have been shortchanged in training by the nature of our past society. But these training programs must be specific to the trainee. and his potential skills in relation to his area and the job needs of the future. A government clerical job for an aerospace engineer would be an economically wasteful dead end and an equally improbable matchup for a husky ghetto teenager of limited literacy. Specific institutions adept at economically training and placing such unemployed to match up with the jobs that will exist at the present recovery, as the present recovery progresses, should be supported now. These would include opportunities, industrialization centers, vocational and technical schools, and the like. For such training programs to have job openings in which to place their clients, the most massive need is to stimulate job creation. The creation of demand has already been accomplished by inventory reduction during this recession and the return of consumer confidence as a result of a degree of price stabilization and increased personal savings. The increase in savings has brought some easing of interest rates in the short run and even rays of hope for longer term lower interest rates. Improvement in the latter is necessary to spur housing starts and underpin the recovery. But any lasting recovery must have expanding plant productivity, and this will require capital investment, considerable capital investment, if we are to meet future national needs for plant modernization, resource development, and expansion of productivity for better future standards of living. The massive investment required calls for us to rethink another of the basic premises of the Full Employment Act era. At the end of World War II, the United States possessed the only massive national capacity of industrial production in the world. That fact, the Great Depression and World War II, made a strong impact on us, an impact that caused our federal fiscal policies and tax laws and our personal standards to be then tilted heavily toward the encouragement of consumption rather than investment. But our goal of full employment in the next generation, as opposed to the last generation, may be more achievable if we will retilt our system to encourage savings over consumption. The encouragement of investment by less confiscatory tax laws on the individual, corporations, and financial institutions, by fewer anti-competitive regulations by government, by more encouragement of conservation, restoration, full utilization, modernization, and research and technical development is fundamental to achieve more job formation in the years ahead. The time for make-work projects to sustain the unemployed is past in the present recession recovery economic cycle. Once the recession has begun, it's generally too late to start planning sophisticated public works because they simply take too long to put people on the job. Those should already be ready to go as they so that they can be started whenever a recession begins. But it is not too late. It is just the right time, in fact, to encourage the development of private jobs by encouraging existing businesses and new entrepreneurs with more generous investment and depreciation write-offs, reduced profits taxes, and easing of anti-competitive federal rules and regulations. We need to redress the imbalance that has been growing for the last 30 years or so if we are to achieve more consistently in the next 30 years our goals of full employment with price stability, whatever the modern balance between those two figures should really be. Mr. Chairman, I thank you for the opportunity to make your presentation.
Thank you very much, Congressman Brown. Now our discussants will proceed. And might I say for the members of the committee that anyone that has a statement, as Senator Robert Taft indicated he had, it will be made a part of the record at this point for the direction of our staff, because I'd like to have those statements in order. Yes, John, and yours will be included as a part of the record. And we will proceed with the discussants, and I'd like them to make their statements and their questions, and then members of the committee who have not participated up to now should be given priority in any questioning. We'll start right out with Mr. Johnson, Byron Johnson. We'll go down the line. Mr. Byron Johnson is from the University of Colorado and well known to many of us here.
Senator, I
would you pull the microphone over, sir?
I enjoyed very much this, and I recognize the historic significance of this. It had been my good fortune, Chairman Byrne, to join the Executive Office of the President in 1942 at the inflationary height in the summer of 42, and the President sent down a request that we put together an economic stabilization program. And we had 6 weeks in the staff to put that together. He sent it down to the Hill and said, I'll give you 3 weeks to pass this, and if you don't do it, I'll do it by executive order under my inherent war powers. And that's how we got the first economic stabilization program on the books in the fall of 1942. I was in the Fiscal Division, which was the precursor of the Council of Economic Advisors, and my colleague, Grover Renzi, became first deputy director and then director of this committee. I've therefore paid some attention over the years to how things have gone. But during World War II, we got along with 1% unemployment at the best. So when I went out to teach at the University of Denver in 47, I told my students that 1% was probably the minimum, 2% was acceptable, but at 3% we should certainly start taking reverse action to overcome this high unemployment, and that by the time unemployment got up to 4%, we should ring alarm bells. In light of that history, I confess I've had great difficulty following the discussion in the past 10 years. I've been most distressed by your difficulty with the numbers game, and yet your statements, both in print and here again today, that you favor full employment. I think it is important that H.R. 50 or something like that get approved to make clear what was left in dispute in 1946. Namely that maximum employment meant full employment, and that full employment does have measurable targets, so we can hold administrators and members of the Federal Reserve Board and the Council hold their feet to the fire. Because as long as we're foggy, as long as we have a high fog index, we can expect that the temptation will be to solve our problem by redefinition. And I confess, as a classmate and student of my good friend Walter Heller, I was distressed when he first used the phrase interim target, because I was sure the word interim would get lost, and sure enough it got lost. So I come at this with the feeling that the time has indeed come for new directions, and Mr. Chairman, at the suggestion of your Chief of Staff, my old friend John Stark, I did prepare a statement on new directions for America under the Employment Act, and also I did prepare a more complete statement on how to restore full employment without inflation, which I won't do more than offer for your consideration.
Well, we'll incorporate it in the record, but I think it would be well for the moment, Professor Johnson, if you just give us a thumbnail sketch of what you call your new directions. Why don't you just run that down? We have the time. We're actually, it's only 11:30, and you weren't even supposed to be on until about a quarter to 12, so you're all right.
It seems to me that the failure to define and accept full employment as a goal in 1946 was a fundamental fumble, and I'm delighted with H.R. 50, S-50, in which you are now, I think, largely running there. Secondly, I think the term maximum production has been a quantitative analysis trap, and that in our society we've got to start looking at the quality of our lives, and I'm delighted to see the kind of specific language which is contained in S-50, because it seems to me it comes to grips with the necessity to start stating some basic social priorities. I was one of the first graduate students to be looking at Keynes. As a matter of fact, I wrote my first paper on Keynes for one Dr. Walter Heller, not yet then a doctor. The only people in Washington who asked me about the Keynes were the National Resources Planning Board when I came down here for interviews in 42. It was a great step forward during the Great Depression to think in terms of full employment. But we need a qualitative as well as a quantitative approach to what America is to be, and I'm delighted to see that kind of language in S-50. Thirdly, I think the phrase maximum purchasing power failed to come to grips with the anti-inflation bias, which I think is the intent of the committee, but was never stated clearly in the law. Indeed, you'll recall when I was a congressman in 1959-60, I was one of the sponsors of Sundry bills to try to write into the Employment Act that at stable general levels of prices ought to be made a part of the law. I'm delighted to see the progress that I now see in H.R. 50. Incidentally, this is the finest draft I've seen that bill, and I want to compliment the drafters and sponsors for the real progress that's been made. I appreciate Congressman Boland's generous compliments to the Speaker for the work that his crew have done behind the scenes. In the fourth place, it seems to me that we speak of the Employment Act calling for the purpose of creating and maintaining in a manner calculated to foster and promote free competitive enterprise. Whatever happened to that phrase? You know, we've got the private control of output and price. Whatever happened to the public review of the private control of output and price? And it's just last month that we celebrated the 200th anniversary. This is a great bicentennial. Adam Smith's book came out 200 years ago this month. And at least at Boulder, our economics faculty, with Ken Boulder, buddy of play, have had a joyful commemoration of that historic event, because the author of Modern Economics warned us what the dangers were of inflation and the private control of output and price. And it seems to me that when we wrote that in the Employment Act, that was the intent of the Congress. It's consistent with everything from this way from the Sherman Act, and why we have to restate that as though it were a policy to be achieved rather than a policy to be enforced, I have some trouble with. So I think it's helpful to have that written into the Act. Fifth, the Employment Act does not address the quality of our lives. And I understand your concern, Dr. Burns, about retreating from speeding up the enforcement of the cleaning up the environment. But the younger generation are here. You know, we always say, well, let's take one more generation. They're here and they don't want to wait. I really think the time has come for the Congress to say, this is national policy. And frankly, as one who teaches land economics, I'm convinced that in most cases, the cleaning up the environment is in fact cost effective. If it isn't cost effective, then perhaps our technologists should be linked with the industrialists to see if we can't find cost effective ways. But I'm wrestling with the rural development program to recycle animal waste, for example, and we're satisfied from the front-end analysis we've done that this is going to be cost-effective. And there are many ways we can clean up the streams and clean up the air and salvage valuable commodities which are now being wasted and polluting the air and our lives. Sixth, it seems to me that the Employment Act neglected the international interdependence that are crystal clear to us today. We can no longer live in a world unto ourselves, and I have been depressed that my colleagues in the field of macroeconomics have been so wholly obsessed with national, gross national product, that the notion of gross world product, the notion of how to maximize welfare for the whole community, have been, it seems to me, lost from view. And seventh, it seems to me the Employment Act needs to reflect our growing awareness that resources are divisible between renewable and non-renewable exhaustive resources, and we must take steps as rapidly as possible to reduce our dependence upon the exhaustible resources. And that means not just to be independent on oil, but to be less dependent upon oil, be more dependent on solar, wind, geothermal, and other inexhaustible sources. And so these, it seems to me, Mr. Chairman, are kinds of new directions, many of which I see reflected in the Employment Act redraft that you have before you. And with those comments, let me only add one other footnote, and it's really a question, I think, to both of you. I've been deeply distressed that macroeconomists suffer from amnesia. When they are discussing how to fight inflation, they say we must have tight money policy. And therefore, since they've forgotten the other terms of credit, they speak of raising interest rates to somehow tighten up. That doesn't make money tighter, it just makes it more expensive. It's the volume of money that's important, not the price of money. And money buys nothing more for you than to pay 2% or 10%. And I lived through World War II with 2% federal money. And we managed to fight inflation without raising interest rates. I think the Accord of the late 40s, early 50s was an abomination. I think the notion that the Fed is independent is an abomination. I was on Rice-Patton's subcommittee, which held the hearings in 1959 and 60, on this mythology that the banks own the Federal Reserve. And if you'll go back and read the hearings of that committee, you'll find that I think we established beyond a shadow of a doubt that the banks do not own the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve is a part of the United States government. Its policy should be to carry out the intent of the will of Congress and the best interest of the parties, not a handmaiden for the banks. And raising interest rates doesn't even serve the banks in the long run. But in any case, I'm absolutely convinced if you're going to fight inflation, you don't throw gasoline in the fire. The raising the price of money is, in fact, an inflationary action, so that I would much rather have you fight to accelerate savings by raising down payments, shorten amortization period, push interest rates down. Then I think you'd get the additional housing that would create the private jobs that we all want. It would encourage the small business. It would encourage the public construction. I've just come from being chairman of my board of regents of the university, and I have great trouble getting the funds to build the facilities that the place needs, because we're looking, even on our bonds, we're looking at 6.38 and 6.8 to borrow money, and other people are looking at 8.5 to 10.5. It seems to me that the failure to use other terms of growth and interest rates have been disastrous for the economy for the last 23 years, and I would seriously hope that you'd give sober thought to alternative policies in this regard, and also that in retreating from wholly being dependent upon macroeconomics, you'd recognize that depressions come in divergent pockets of our society, in age, in race, in location, and in sectors of the economy, and that a somewhat more sensitive microeconomic policy in the field of the monetary policy might do far more. The attempt to use the axe to kill the fly seems to me is wrong. I think we need to use some scalpels to do our surgery, and we need the fly spotters for the flies and not the sledgehammers.
All right, I know, Dr. Burns, that you're taking for notes or mental notes, and we want you to come back because I want to encourage a good dialogue here. And I'd kind of like to keep ducking while you're going at it. There's some experts around here. We have our next participant will be Mr. Harrington. We welcome you and ask you for your participation now.
And Mr. Chairman, I'd like to just raise a couple of themes.
Yes.
Because I think that they impinge very much on the discussion of full employment in the United States. First of all, there's a myth, which I think the report of this committee and the Congressional Budget Office could do much to dispel, which I think inhibits our debate. That myth, and it's not just a Republican myth, it's now even in the Democratic Party a myth, is that the government has been doing so much, that we threw so much money at problems, that we acted so radically, that we innovated so much. And that's why we failed. And I'd like to point out that the Congressional Budget Office, in its report for this year, shows that for the last two decades, federal spending has only increased on a full employment basis from 17 to 20%. Secondly, I'd like to point out that the main area of increase has been an area of extremely effective spending for the aging in the United States. The main spending increases, the quantum leaps in America, have been in Social Security benefits and in Medicare. I don't know of a single politician, even Ronald Reagan, who's going to come out against Social Security and Medicare.
Ain't too sure about that.
Thirdly, the committee in its report points out, and this is a fact that I think most Americans don't realize, that federal employment as a percentage of civilian employment has been going down. And what I want to suggest is that we did some good things with our money. We did not act radically. I think Pat Moynihan really put his finger on it in his book on the politics of the guaranteed annual income when he said in the 60s, the social programs were underfinanced and oversold. We talked as if we were doing so much. We didn't do so much, and now if we're going to do what we have to do, we have to get over the myth that we did so much. Second point I'd like to raise. I'm afraid it's sort of a bipartisan point because it's a criticism of Humphrey Hawkins, which I support as the focus, which I would vote for in almost any version if I urge someone to vote for. It's a criticism of Hawkins, Humphrey, and Dr. Burns, and sort of a criticism of a lot of people. That is, I think this country has got an ideological prejudice, a non-empirical proposition that public employment is bad and private employment is good. I don't believe you can demonstrate it. I don't believe that overbuilding Florida condominiums and Las Vegas casinos is better than having a decent health system. I don't believe that having the government nationalize all the losses of the railroads while leaving all of the profits to the private sector is a rational policy. I do believe, for example, not that government should be the employer of last resort, but that in some cases it should be the employer of first resort. I would like to see, and in this I agree with Leonard Woodcock and the UAW and many others, I would like to see publicly owned railroads in the United States nationalize the profitable as well as the losing sector and put Americans to work restoring railroads, an environmentally benign, energy-saving form of transportation, which was ruined precisely because our lack of planning and our following the corporate priorities of the trucking industry and the oil industry, et cetera, rather than the national needs, putting the railroads back in some kind of decent shape under public ownership. And I say this in part because I'm a socialist, but you don't have to be a socialist to have to be commonsensical about this. You can, and it is common sense, it seems to me, to understand that public employment in many cases can be better than private employment. And one of the, my criticisms of Humphrey Hawkins within a framework of supporting is that I think it reflects that, it reflects Dr. Burns' prejudice, which I think is very non-empirical, very ideological. Last point, and then let me very briefly conclude. The last point comes in the minority section of the Joint Economic Committee report and in Congressman Brown's remarks. I fear that under the guise of redefining full employment, we're about to do something which I'm told that the Australians once did with the Aborigines. They didn't count them in the census, because Aborigines weren't people. And I know there's a tendency to say, well, look, you've now got a lot of teenagers in the labor market. You've now got a lot of women in the labor market. Therefore, you tolerate higher levels of unemployment because, after all, it's merely teenagers and women. And I would point out to you that teenage, in this case, is a euphemism in many situations for a generation of black and other minority youth who are being absolutely devastated by the experience of this recession. And I think at a time when women are coming into the labor market and claiming a rightful place in the labor market, to say, well, their unemployment is not as important, in effect, as male unemployment, is tragic. And I even see this, by the way, in one of the revisions of Hawkins-Humphrey I didn't like, which was introducing a means test to qualify for a job. Defining the means test in terms of households, I suspect, might be a way of saying you've got to choose between a male employee in the family and a female employee in the family. And I've got a good guess in this society who would lose in that trade-off. But finally, Mr. Chairman, I just want to say that for all of my criticisms of this or that aspect of Hawkins-Humphrey, I think this is one of the most important steps that's been undertaken in American society. And perhaps I could even help you by criticizing the bill a bit while supporting it, because I really want to tell Secretary Simon that it's not socialism. In my opinion, it's not half of that good, but it's as good as we can get under the circumstances, and I'm tremendously happy we're making that step forward.
Well, we thank you very much, Mr. Harrington. As I would have expected, your comment is incisive and helpful, and I would gather a bit provocative. We appreciate it very much. Our next participant is Dr. Eisner from Northwestern University. Heard from you before, and we welcome your attendance here again.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I'm very glad to be here. I may not be quite as provocative as Mr. Harrington, but I'll try. I think that there are some very important issues that have bedeviled discussion of full employment policy for now 3 decades, and I find them remaining unresolved. Resolved, with all due respect, in the statements of Dr. Burns and Mr. Greenspan, and that of a number of committee members. To begin with, there is this notion to broaden the line and perpetuate it over and over, that inflation and unemployment are twin evils. They're not twin evils. The situation is asymmetric. There are many things that contribute to inflation that have nothing to do with the rate of unemployment. I think in some of its most extreme form, you get statements which I think Mr. Greenspan came pretty close to indicating that above all, combat inflation, and we cannot try to recover from this recession in a way that will contribute to it again, the notion being somehow that the inflation has contributed to the recession. That was stated very flatly by a presidential candidate in my state, not the presidential candidate that Mr. Greenspan, I presume, is working for, when Mr. Reagan indicated very flatly, and these were television spots that came over and over again, that this inflation is what has brought on the recession and the unemployment. I think that's perpetuating a myth in the American people. It's spreading misinformation to a population which has a hard time trying to make out economic realities to begin with. The reason, in fact, we can associate the recent inflation with the unemployment we have is, I would judge, and I'm sure many other economists have as well, essentially some very misguided policies of the administration in the last several years. Unless we learn from those policies, learn correctly, Mr. Greenspan's injunction to avoid getting to the same place again, I think, is not going to be realized. What we had was an inflation, of course, which was overwhelmingly generated by prices over which we had little control, prices of petroleum products and essential raw materials. In the face of that kind of inflation, somehow the fiscal and monetary authorities decided the thing to do is to hold down demand. With prices going up, they either permitted or encouraged a very large swing in fiscal policy, which gave people essentially less to spend to buy all the other goods and services that could be produced. For example, in the second half of 1972, when a president inspiring for four more years inspired the economy, we had a full employment budget deficit of $10.9 billion. In the second half of 1974, we had a surplus of $29.9 billion. And I should try to avoid such technicalities, but I think most of us here know that that is probably the best measure of a $40 billion swing in the effect of federal fiscal policy in a repressive direction to hold down demand. That kind of a swing, that kind of a jolt to the economy, is something that not even an economy as basically prosperous and productive as ours can withstand. That's the lesson of past policy to watch, not the notion that somehow government spending and deficits fueled inflation. Indeed, I might add to Dr. Burns' consideration the observation that in that same period, as we swung into what Mr. Greenspan correctly called our worst recession, and by far since the Great Depression of the 30s, the rate of growth of the money supply changed from a plus 10.1% to a plus 3.9%. Now, of course, you know, unsophisticated people may say we had inflation. Look, the money supply was growing. In fact, the money supply was growing considerably less than it had grown at the beginning of this period when we swung into a very substantial recession, and indeed into some substantial inflation in 1974. The fact then is that much of our inflation is due at this point in time, in the last several years, to increases in prices of a supply nature. And in trying to combat that, we must watch for those kinds of tax policies and regulations which in fact simply aggravate the problem of cost and the problem of the supply price which influences final price. Now, there is associated with this problem on combating inflation versus unemployment. Well, I might just add, you know, another few words here. I know if you have any public opinion poll on what the greatest problem facing the economy is, except at our peak unemployment recently, inflation always seems to come out of the top. I dare say most of the public does not really perceive what they're suffering from. If prices went up 12% and incomes went up 18%, we'd all grumble about inflation, but we would tolerate it in good form. When prices go up 12% and incomes go up 6%, we're in an awful shape. But of course, that is simply reflecting the fact that the gross national product in real terms has declined by 6%. What the public fails to sometimes perceive, and I'm not sure that we always educate them properly, is that economics is a hard discipline, and the real payoff to the public ultimately is the total volume of goods and services produced. It's not the prices which are charged for them, although that can be painful to those that don't find their incomes going up. If the total pie is less, then we have less, no matter what has happened to the price level. I think we have to put that context around some of the remarks that the chairman has made here and that Mr. Jabbas has made. The fact really is that the unemployed are not the only ones who suffer from unemployment. Unfortunately, it's too widely perceived that way, and as a consequence, I don't know how elections will turn out. There have been some of my respected colleagues have been doing studies showing that, perhaps cynically, that I'm tending to be cynical, that no matter how bad the situation is, has been, people will vote for a party which is associated with some improvement. So if unemployment was at 9% a couple of years ago, and by election time it is declining, people say that's great, even though 7.6% is still higher than the average bottom of all of our post-war recessions. So, the real fact is that the unemployment is a disaster to the economy as a whole. We can note that as a consequence of even our current unemployment, we are producing output at a rate some $150 billion per year, or to $200 billion per year, less than that which we would be producing if we had merely been projecting along the normal growth path from 1973. I was among those, I suppose, most horrified both by the wrongness and the tremendous loss in the war of Vietnam. How many of us have stopped to think that in all of our years of combat in Southeast Asia, we lost in total output, and the cost of that measured to the Treasury was about $150 billion, and that is less than what we have been losing per year in output because of the fact that we simply are not utilizing the skills and labor of all the people who want to work. Now, I might add, you know, finally on this inflation recession business, I wonder how many of you reflected on the remarks I know to send the bond market up by Secretary Simon a day or two ago, very optimistic, predicting a 2% rate of inflation before long. I forget now the precise date of that, and also a substantial reduction in unemployment. Now, how could he be forecasting a great drop in unemployment and a drop in the rate of inflation? I'm not at all sure he's right. Certainly, we all hope he's right. But I wonder if in the back of his mind was a notion that maybe there are other things happening. Maybe, for example, looking at the fact also in the papers that the price of sugar fell from 64 cents a pound in the world markets fairly recently to about 15 cents per pound. Now, that has nothing to do with Mr. Greenspan's tight budget or Dr. Burns, a relatively modest growth from the money supply. That has nothing to do with the notion, for example, that Dr. Burns expresses that highly expansionary monetary and fiscal policies might for a short time provide some additional thrust to economic activity, but inflation would inevitably accelerate. That is from his speech in Georgia in September. Now, why should we say that? I mean, it's sort of conventional to say, Dr. Burns is saying, but many other respected and learned people, not all as respected and learned as he, will say, why does expansionary policy, highly expansionary policy, as he say, inevitably lead to inflation? When Mr. Greenspan welcomes a huge drop in unemployment, which our figures seem to show huge because we're so high to begin with, we're still very high, he apparently is reporting upon a major expansion in economic activity. Well, that was an expansion in economic activity which apparently has not caused inflation. Why should an expansion in economic activity brought about by conscious government policy bring about any inflation? You know, it's utterly unclear. There seems to be a growing notion that somehow, if we recover too fast, it's bad. I've never heard any doctor prescribe that to a patient and say, you know, you're awfully sick, but I've decided you should take 4 or 5 years to recover. Otherwise, who knows what the consequences will be. Well, that's not true for a sick patient. It's not true for the economy. Now, there are another set of policies and points which emerge in Mr. Greenspan's remarks and Dr. Burns and that of a number of members of the committee. Somehow, the thing to do is to stimulate private investment. And now, I was delighted by Dr. Burns' remarks in terms of his faith in a free enterprise economy. I should assure all of you that I'll bow to nobody in my defense of that as well, in the notion of free competition. Free competition, which I think can include competition between government enterprises and private enterprises. But how in the world can so many advocates of competition say, well, we believe in free competition, we believe in leaving business alone, and then say, but we have to have incentives to stimulate private investment. We have to say, we don't trust a businessman to spend the right amount on plant, on equipment, on training and research and development. We have decided the economy needs tampering with, and we're going to give them a 10% equipment tax credit or a 12% equipment tax credit, something to make them spend more on equipment. I would submit that investment is very important. Capital accumulation, these figures. If you define capital formation broadly as all that productive activity today which will contribute to output in the future, including not only plant and equipment purchases by business, but plant and equipment purchases, housing, durable goods by consumers, by government. If you include as well the huge formation of human capital and education and job training, you know what you'll find? You'll find that the business expenditures for plant and equipment are at most some 20% of our total capital formation. Now, who is anybody in the Congress or of officers say, we've decided that capital formation should be exclusively the purchase of plant and equipment by business? That we're going to encourage. I would say there's a huge loss in capital formation in this unemployment. There are figures which indicate that 20% of those 16 to 19 are out of work, 50% in the black ghettos. That kind of unemployment means that large fractions of a generation that never get the investment in their own skills, in training, in job experience, participation in the economic system, which will make them productive in the future. Now, all of that, I think, should be central to the much welcome discussions that we're having of trying to invigorate the Employment Act and really renew a commitment to full employment in this society.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Dr. Eisner. Mr. Morris, Frank Morris, is the president of the Boston Federal Reserve Bank, and we appreciate your coming to us again, Mr. Morris.
Senator, I'm pleased to be here. I will even...
Following your presentation, I want to permit my esteemed friend, Dr. Burns, to make some rejoinder here. I believe Dr. Greenspan will be back with us so that we can do that.
I will leave it to Mr. Burns to comment on the other panelists' remarks on monetary policy. My silence should not be interpreted as agreement. What I would like to do is to comment on the Humphrey-Hawkins bill, a bill to revise the present Full Employment Act. I've been studying it for the past few days, and I find many things that I like in it, and a few things that concern me about it. But to talk about the things I like about it first, I think it goes a long way toward meeting the need that Congressman Bowling stated, the need to establish a new consensus in this country on economic policy. First, I like the recognition in the bill that monetary and fiscal policies are inadequate alone to establish the kind of employment and unemployment levels we'd like to see in this country. That if we try to push monetary and fiscal policy too far, we are likely, almost certain, to generate a high rate of inflation, which in turn will lead to recession and unemployment. That we need to have supplemental public employment programs if we are to come close to the kinds of unemployment levels that we talked about in the early days of the Full Employment Act. I like the enunciation in the Act of the right to a job for every American who is willing to work. I like the recognition, the explicit recognition, that inflation is a major national problem for the United States, a recognition which was not in the original Full Employment Act. I like the emphasis on the need for economic balance as a goal of policy as well as full employment, because I think in any long-term sense, economic balance and full employment have to accompany each other. I like the fact that the bill would establish on a permanent basis supplementary employment programs. I think our experience of the past is to turn these programs on in recession years and turn them off, and as a consequence, we have never been in a position really to evaluate very carefully which of these programs were successful and which were failures. So I think recognition of the fact that a part of our employment problem is likely to be a chronic one needing a permanent approach to it is an important part of the Act. And finally, I like the orientation of the Act toward a maximum feasible substitution of work for income maintenance. I think there is a growing feeling in this country that we have probably gone too far on income maintenance and not far enough in job creation. And as a consequence, we have damaged the incentive structure of the country. And it's something we're going to have to address ourselves to. Now, to point to the things that concern me, the Act, the bill states that we should have as our goal a minimum level of unemployment consistent with the frictional unemployment necessary for efficient job search and mobility in the labor force. And it states that this number is 3%. Now, one thing that concerns me about enunciating the 3% target is that I fear that we may not be able to attain this target without a reform of the unemployment compensation system, and that this is something that the Congress should take a serious look at in the process. For example, I'll give you one example of what I'm talking about, the problem of temporary layoffs. Our present unemployment compensation system encourages employers to gear their operations to temporary layoffs. It encourages them because our experience rating system does not penalize anywhere near sufficiently the employer who gears his operations to temporary layoffs. And at any one point in time, a significant percentage of total unemployment is reflecting people who are temporarily laid off. Now, the evidence suggests that 85% of people temporarily laid off ultimately go back to work for the original employer. The unemployment compensation benefits are high enough to discourage a search for work on the part of someone who is temporarily laid off because he has a conviction that well within the time before his benefits run out, he will be rehired by his original employer. So I think we've got built into our structure a sizable amount of unemployment, which is going to make hitting the target of 3% very difficult without a reform of the unemployment compensation system. And incidentally, I think that one other aspect of this is that the employer who gears his work to temporary layoffs is really pushing a part of his cost of operation onto the rest of society. So I think, first, Congress has to face up to the fact that the attainment of the 3% goal will require less liberal income maintenance programs. Second, I think, thing that the Congress is going to have to face up to is the scale of public employment that we're talking about. I think most economists feel that monetary and fiscal policies should be geared to move our economy to a level of unemployment as we currently calculate it of somewhere in the neighborhood of 4.5% to 5.5%. But if we push beyond this range, we are likely to generate accelerating inflation again. Well, if you would accept for the purposes of argument these numbers, this means that we're talking about, in the context of the 3% program, 3% goal, we're talking about 1.5 to 2.5 million public jobs, which is a massive undertaking. And I think we have a learning process to go through here if this program is to be carried off successfully. I think we have a need for a number of pilot projects to try to figure out how we can do this in a sensible way. Because I think if we rush into it without sufficient preparation, the whole idea may be discredited, and we may go back to reliance on income maintenance programs instead of jobs, which I think would be harmful to the incentive structure of the country. Now, in the area of unemployment, the problem which I think is most troublesome to me is the high level of unemployment among our youth. And this, I think, is something that the Congress has really got to focus on very heavily. We, both at the federal level and state and local level, subsidize very heavily with public money higher education for our young people. But we do practically nothing to help the young person who is not going on to higher education. This is where our problem lies, it seems to me. Our educational institutions are not providing our young people who do not go on to college with the kinds of skills needed to prepare them for the labor force. Now, at the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston, we have conducted for several years, a small program of our own to train young people in clerical skills. Every 6 months, we take on 12 young people, many of them black, Spanish-speaking, from the Roxbury area of Boston. People who cannot meet our minimum hiring standards because they can't read and write properly, they can't add up a series of numbers properly, they do not have the training to bring them into our bank and put them to work on day one. So we put them in for 6 months in our clerical skills training program. And the results of this program have been very heartening. We've been running for several years, and we've got a track record now of the people who have graduated from this program. 75% of these young people are working today, either for the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston or for some of the other institutions in Boston who hired them away from us. And that, I think, is a very heartening record. I think if we could multiply this little program of ours a thousandfold, we could really do something constructive to help the young people entering the labor force who do not have the skills to find a good paying job. So I think the government has a lot to learn. I believe in the concept of employer of last resort, but I also believe that we've got a lot to learn about how to put this program to work. Thank you.
Well, Mr. Morris, you have been most constructive and I think very helpful to us here. Let me quickly say that the main thrust of that S-50 or HR-50 is to require the government to search into the kind of solutions and adaptations that you're talking about. The bill itself, outside of the supplementary employment features and the countercyclical aspects, is a process, a methodology. And I don't want to go into it here, but just to say that you have pointed out, again, what needs to be thought about in terms of an employment program, and not just saying, well, we're going to hire somebody, but how we get at it. Now, Dr. Burns, I just can't hardly wait here. I know that you have been most patient, and I think you're entitled to lots of time, and we're going to do it this way. We'd like to have you and Dr. Greenspan make response, and then I want my colleagues that have not participated here to get in here. Would you like to take on a couple at a time, or just one at a time?
Well, I'm not in a very quarrelsome mood today. This is, after all, a celebration of the
I would have put you in charge of the Disarmament Commission, Dr. Burns.
I will take advantage of your invitation and make a few comments in reply first to Mr. Johnson, then to Mr. Harrington, then to Mr. Eisner. I'm not going to quarrel at all with Mr. Morris, we do our quarreling in private.
For the time being.
Mr. Johnson, as far as interest rates in our country, or for that matter, elsewhere around the world, they are dominated by our inflation experience and inflationary fears. You take short-term interest rates at the present time, are in the neighborhood, short-term open market interest rates in the neighborhood of 5%, which is lower than the inflation rate. Now, your long-term rate, yes, is high, uncomfortably high, 8, 9, 10%, but with a basic inflation rate of 6 or 7%, the real rate of interest is really not high at all. The fact is that an inflation premium is built into our long-term interest country, and for that matter around the world. If you were to look at interest rates in Latin American countries, you'd find that they are in the high double-digit figures. Why? Because of the inflation rate. And let's not lose sight of that factor. Now, I'd like to say a word also about independence of the Federal Reserve System. You will find that you have many supporters believe that independence of the Federal Reserve System doesn't serve a sound national purpose. I would call just two facts to your attention. First, that we in our country have had an independent central bank, and Germany has had an independent central bank, and they are the two strong independent central banks on the world. And poor though our record of inflation is, it is one of the very best among the nations, and certainly the same is true of Germany. I call that to your attention. Second, what are we talking about when we speak of, divesting the Federal Reserve of its independence? Well, you can try to do that, and let's see how. One is to let Congress make monetary policy. That is utterly unrealistic. Monetary policy has to be adjusted not only from month to month, but literally from hour to hour. We operating in the markets. Congress couldn't possibly do it. It doesn't make any sense.
What about some goals that are not in your present law?
What
about some goals that are not in your present law?
What about goals?
In other words, shouldn't you be coherent with some national goals? That's what I'm asking for. I don't want day-to-day policy.
Well, I'll comment on that presently, but let me just continue. Next, you can certainly put the Federal Reserve under the thumb of the White House, and many people believe that should be done. And people think in these terms or have a idealistic concept of the White House. They think of the Oval Office and its majesty. They think of the president at his desk, surrounded by wise advisors, calling on each of them for his opinion, calling in competent, highly qualified public citizens, and then pondering these issues of monetary policy and finally reaching a decision. The fact of the matter is, if monetary policy were found its home in the White House, some fellow in the basement of the White House, he might even be called an alderman, would in effect be making monetary policy. I'm not sure you really want that. Now, as for goals, Sandra Humphrey commented on my views on that subject. It's the business of the Congress to set national goals, and obviously, we at the Federal Reserve, these goals being specified, being law-abiding, being conscientious, we would live within the mandate of the Congress. Now, we might quarrel with the Congress in setting the mandate, and the Congress might not like the way in which we pursue the goals set by the Congress, but there can be no question about our living within the law and respecting the law to the best of our ability. Let me turn to Mr. Harrington. I admired your eloquence, Mr. Harrington. I was disturbed a little when you stated that you would vote on almost any version of the Humphrey-Hawkins bill. That delighted my good friend Senator Humphrey. But when I thought about that statement, you did say almost, and there was a saving grace in that remark. Now, you spoke also of the government as serving, in your judgment, at times as employer of first resort. Of course, it should. I have no quarrel with that. I don't think any conservative economist would quarrel with that. You spoke of nationalization of railroads. Well, I don't know that I have much of a quarrel with you even on that subject. Think of the sorry state in which our railroads find themselves. They have been overregulated by the government. Initiative has been squeezed out of business enterprise. They have been dominated by trade unions. Impossible work rules have been imposed on these railroads. And now, with initiative, dynamism squeezed out of most of our railroads, they are ripe for nationalization. Not because nationalization is a good thing, but because the railroad industry has been corrupted by government and by the trade unions. Next, you spoke of my penchant proclivity towards free enterprise. You're quite right about that. But you commented that there's no empirical basis for that. I had to read an article written by a newspaper man in this room. I see him here, Mark Rowan. An article that he wrote in the Washington Post yesterday on the British economy. And that may indicate to you, as it did to me, that there is some empirical basis for questioning the blessings of socialism. Now, let me say a word or two to my friend Mr. Eisner. When Mr. Eisner argues that the factors on the supply side must bear their share of responsibility for the inflation that we've had, of course he's right, and I agree with him fully. But when he is virtually silent, I may have misinterpreted Mr. Eisner, on the way in which we have conducted our federal deficits, I think that is a glaring omission. Year after year, in good years and bad years, we've run a huge deficit in our federal finances. What does that mean? It means the federal government has pumped more money into the pocketbooks of people than has taken out of the pocketbooks of people. You take the 10-year stretch from 1966 through this year, using the estimate for this fiscal year, I think the cumulative deficit in the federal budget is some $217 billion, and if you count in off-budget outlays and outlays by government-sponsored enterprises, the figure runs up to about $300 billion. So I think that our federal deficits have played an enormous role in causing inflation.
May I just raise a question there, Dr. Burns? Why do you indicate that a deficit must increase the quantity of money? You can control the money supply. All you have to do is see to it that the deficit is financed exclusively by the selling of bonds, if your concern is the money supply.
Well, Mr. Johnson has just commented on the will of the Congress, and the Humphrey has commented on the will of the Congress. If the Congress proceeds to appropriate money at such a rate, for us to fight the Congress would hardly be in conformity with the congressional will. Now and then, of course, we do resist. We lean against the wind. We've done that. Also, if what you wish to say is, Mr. Eisner, is that we've made mistakes of the Federal Reserve, of course we've made mistakes. Congressman Bowling isn't here. I think he put his finger on the start of all of our difficulties within the past decade. He was wrong by 1 year, but his generalization was valid. You go back to the year 1965. What did we do in that year? We had the second installment in the reduction of the personal income tax. We had the second installment in the reduction of the corporate income tax. We legislated a sizable reduction in excise taxes. We inaugurated great society programs. We financed, got underway, huge financing of the war in Vietnam. And I'm sorry to say that while the Federal Reserve in December 1965 made a symbolic gesture by raising the discount rate, and all hell did break loose when that happened, we did not follow up sufficiently in our open market policy in 1966.
It was also the beginning of the time for real off-budget financing, too.
Yes, and that's been growing.
But I'd like to also cite that the rate of unemployment was under 4% and the rate of the inflation was under 4%.
Unemployment has always been long apart. And the inflation rate didn't last.
There weren't many people at war in 1965. Now, let's knock that one off.
Well,
the Federal Reserve proved that the very month that the federal government normally makes its tough economic decisions inside the executive, it was a terrible blunder, in my opinion, for the Fed to preempt the president's necessity to face up to his budgetary situation in preparing his budget and the recommendation for January of 66. The timing by the Fed took the Congress off the hook and gave the American public the wrong impression that you'd done something meaningful. I'm glad you said it was a blunder, but the blunder most of all, bad seems to be in terms of timing. You should have held the executive's feet to the fire and Congress' feet to the fire for a couple more months.
Well, one can argue that.
Well, to tighten up too much would have resulted in further crowding out, and you had in 67 and 68 a kick in the teeth to the housing market because of what happened to interest rates. Is my memory failing in that?
I want to say one word more on your comment, Professor Eisner, on tax census. If I understand you correctly, you argue here, awful conservatives like Alan Greenspan, Arthur Burns, Clarence Brown, others argue that tax incentives are deserved. You go on to say that in arguing in this fashion, we are expressing a certain distrust, a certain lack of confidence in the business community. If we trust the businessmen, why do we have to give them tax incentives? Now, that was the grist of your argument, if I understood
it correctly. Yes, I'll say that's implicit. I'm sure you don't intend that, but that clearly is implicit. You wouldn't leave the economy to yourself.
All right, so I've understood you correctly. Now, when we talk about tax incentives, what are we talking about? In order to stimulate investment, we're talking about reducing taxes on investors, reducing the taxes on business, who impose the high and in some instances nearly confiscatory taxes. It was government who did that. It is therefore those of us who plead for tax incentives are simply pleading for a correction of a governmental mistake. And we have in mind very much what has been happening in a country across the Atlantic, a wonderful land, which is suffering from its own confiscatory taxation.
And the remedy is to eliminate confiscatory taxation. I doubt that the corporate profits tax would be called confiscatory, but I, for one, would strongly advocate eliminating the corporate profits tax, integrating with the individual income tax, but not have a special loophole for the purchase of equipment or anything else. Don't start having that. I'm not a specialist on the British economy, but if anything wrecks the British economy, it is nominally high tax rates, huge tax rates, and then loopholes in capital gains, loopholes on this and that. That leaves business paralyzed. All it can do is engage in those activities that which government offers an excuse.
It discourages capital formation. It discourages formation of productive capacity, doesn't it?
The discouragement of capital formation is recession itself. You'll find that business expenditures for plant and equipment in real terms took a drop of, I believe Mr. Greenspan may have the figures handy, but I'd say about 20 to 25% in the recent recession, perhaps it's larger. That has nothing to do with changes in tax money. I will let business invest when it considers investment opportunities profitable. If they're not profitable,